Well, it's like the damage has been done, and we're gonna give you a couple of dollars, leave us alone. That's the way it feels to me. It shouldn't have happened long time ago.
Today on the Politics Podcast, Willie Earl Vereen, the Wilmington 10, and years of unrest that preceded one of the greatest injustices in North Carolina history. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Perhaps you've heard of the Wilmington 10. If not, here's the abridged story. In the 1970s, there was a push to desegregate public schools across the state, South, and really the country. In plenty of places, it didn't go well. This was especially true in Wilmington, North Carolina. In early 1971, black students, fed up with the conditions of the new Hanover County schools, staged a boycott inside of Gregory Congregational Church. For weeks, dozens and dozens of teenagers skipped school to try to pressure the district into action, change. This was a strategy that had worked elsewhere in North Carolina. State funding was tied to attendance numbers. If students stayed away, the money could disappear as well. This boycott was met with efforts of intimidation and violence. Some students said they were followed home. Others heard gunshots fired from pickup trucks passing by the church. Fortunately, no one was struck, but things escalated. After weeks of bullets, the students abandoned any approach toward pacifism and armed themselves in self-defense. Weeks after the protests began, tensions were near a climax. On February 6th, a white-owned business in a black neighborhood, Mike's Grocery, was firebombed. Two people, one black, one white, were killed that night. The National Guard was called in, and 2 days later, they forced their way into the church. However, by that time, the students were gone. The story then actually hits an unexpected pause for about a year. There were no immediate arrests. In fact, it wasn't until 1972 when Willie Earl Vereen found himself in trouble with the law, even though he didn't much care for the boycott or the movement.
No, I'm a musician. I always played music and had to keep my grades up to at least a B. You know, so that was cool with me, man. Political part of the world and the racist part of the world and all these isms that we have now, socialism, fascism, and all these isms, man, I didn't know anything about.
Vereen hadn't been anywhere near downtown Wilmington when the firebombing at Mike's Grocery occurred. Still, a year later, he heard that early morning knock at the door and found himself facing an M16.
Me and my father looked at my mother, and she said, go get the gun. And she told him, get the hell out of my house. And so my father had to grab my mother, man, and hold her down on the ground. That's when officer came in with an M16, with a bayonet, and put it straight to my head. Told me I was under arrest.
This is when Willie Earl Vereen became Wilmington 10 Willie. Vereen, eight other black men, and one white woman were arrested, charged, tried, and convicted, each sentenced to decades for their alleged role in the plot to firebomb Mike's Grocery. With the 10 in prison, an international eye turned to Wilmington. What had really happened? Was the trial fair? Were the right perpetrators behind bars? Vereen spent 5 years incarcerated for a crime he has always denied being a part of. A drummer since his youth, Vereen was actually playing a gig out of town when the firebombing occurred. In 1978, under considerable pressure, Governor Jim Hunt reduced the sentences of the Wilmington 10. 2 years after that, the convictions were deemed officially bogus. In December of 1980, the Federal Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals throughout the guilty verdicts. Blatant racial profiling was used to eliminate black jurors at trial and impanel racist ones. The prosecution bribed witnesses, and a key witness had repeatedly perjured himself on the stand. Yet it took another 32 years until 2012 for the Wilmington 10 to receive a pardon. On her final day of office, Governor Bev Perdue pardoned the Wilmington 10, and a few months later, they received compensation for their wrongful imprisonment.
Well, it's like the damage has been done, and we're going to give you a couple of dollars, leave us alone. That's the way it feels to me. It shouldn't have happened long time ago. Then you're going to wait 40 years for us to beg you again for a pardon of innocence. I feel just as bad now as I did when they picked me up. I really do. This thing has to change, man. A lot of black people in Wilmington don't even know that we got compensated or pardoned of innocence. They don't even know that. They're steadfast on we're guilty. So, didn't help me any.
There are books, oral histories, documentaries, and much more about the Wilmington 10. The court proceedings themselves could undoubtedly fill several podcast episodes, but we're not focusing on the trial here. Instead, something of a prequel. To better understand the firebombing of Mike's grocery store in Wilmington, North Carolina on February 6, 1971, 50 years ago this week, let us go back to 1968 and the evening of April 4th in Memphis, Tennessee.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee.
King was struck in the face by a bullet from a Remington rifle as he stood on the balcony of room 306 at the Lorraine Motel. He was 39. The assassination marked the end of King's nonviolent quest for equality and the beginning of a new chapter in civil unrest. In the wake of King's murder, there were widespread protests, violence and property damage, and another lingering strain on American race relations in his absence. Then came a push for school desegregation, and from the Old South to the Northeast, this effort was deeply strained. Whites resisted so-called busing efforts, and blacks stood by as pillars of their community were taken away, generally by white school boards and elected officials. To bring us from Memphis to Wilmington, it's worth citing a little-known footnote of history. You see, that fateful day King was killed, he was supposed to be here in North Carolina, scheduled to speak in Wilmington at Williston High School. And to understand the Wilmington 10, you have to understand the importance of Williston High School.
It was called the greatest school under the sun.
Situated on 7th Street, Williston was founded by abolitionists in 1866 after the Union had seized Wilmington and as the city's black community began to prosper. Again, Willie Earl Vereen.
It meant a lot to me and it meant a lot to my family. It meant a lot to every black person that went to school in Wilmington, North Carolina. Everybody wanted to graduate from Williston Senior High School, because it was an industrial high school. It gave us a sense of pride and dignity and self-respect.
At this time, during the late 1960s, Vereen attended Williston Junior High. It was on the same street as a black elementary school and the high school. There were five black schools close to one another, and attending one was a symbol of pride and upward mobility. Among Williston's high school graduates, Philip Clay, who went on to become chancellor at MIT, Meadowlark Lemon, a future basketball Hall of Famer, jazz legend Percy Heath, and Joseph McNeil, one of the four North Carolina A&T freshmen who sat down at an all-white lunch counter in February of 1960. Historian Larry Rainey Thomas grew up in Wilmington.
You go to elementary school at Gregory, then you go to Williston Junior High, and you would walk across the ramp. If you were in the ninth grade, that's all you live for, was to walk across that ramp going to Williston Senior High School.
When that community came alive, describe for us what it looked like, what it felt like.
People were happy. You have to understand, it's in a predominantly African-American community, right? So it's like a Garden of Eden. You hardly ever saw white folks come over there. So it was like there was a sanctuary, man. It was like an oasis for them. And football games and dances and, basketball games, baseball games. And it would always graduate these fine athletes. It was a festival, man. Closing Williston was a major boo-boo.
Black students from Williston were sent to Hoggard and New Hanover high schools. Willie Earl Vereen likened that to losing your home.
You paid up all your insurance, your taxes, your mortgage is paid up, and they just come and take your house, put you on the street. That's what it felt like. Because when I went to Hoggard, I could feel the hatred coming from these white people. You know, I knew that they didn't want us there. Why? Because we were black. And that felt real bad, you know? You got to be somewhere where you're not wanted.
Williston High School was a symbol of hope and pride within the black community. But following King's assassination and the renewed effort to integrate, some schools, primarily black ones, were placed on the chopping block. In Wilmington, the local school board didn't allocate the necessary funds to Williston, and the school board had no intention of possibly sending white students to a black school, even if it was a really good one. So within months of King's death, Williston, that symbol of pride for the black community, was shuttered.
When they closed down Williston, they bussed these students from the African-American communities. And a lot of them came from the projects, which were places that white folks didn't, unless you might have been an insurance man or something like that to collect insurance money, you knew better than to stay there, right? So when they were bussed out to these schools, Hoggard School, and some of them were bused to Nine Harbor High School, but they could walk to Nine Harbor High School. But Hoggard High School is in the suburbs, right? So they didn't get along very well with these folks. I think that's an understatement.
The N-word was called from whites. There were fights. The whites hung on one side of the smoking area, blacks hung on the other side. Wasn't too much intermingling.
With limited intermingling, the effort to integrate sputtered over the next 2.5 years. And by Christmas 1970, a boycott was imminent. Student activists saw the closing of their cherished high school, Williston, as part of a larger disinvestment in the black community. This was throughout Wilmington. Their demands ranged from paving and lighting the streets in black neighborhoods to more fair zoning for the school board. In a letter from the Wilmington Movement to City Hall, students wrote, quote, "We are seeking to be free. We are made in the image of God. We are black and we are proud. We see very, very clearly that the Do Nothing for the Black Community action over the years has produced ominous signs indeed for the black revolution." Close quote. Meanwhile, white supremacist gangs roved town, seeking to intimidate. The Klan was the more moderate of these gangs, if you can believe it. A group called the Rights of White People hung an effigy of the white superintendent.
So there were fights every day, almost every day, fights. And there were even some older white folks, poor whites, basically, coming on campus and harassing black students. You know, and this is what led to the boycott, because what happened was these students weren't able to see their favorite cheerleaders or their favorite ball players. I mean, they knew these people were very, very good athletes, but yet the coaches wouldn't allow them on the teams. So that pissed them off. And that's how the boycott transpired. That's how the boycott came into being.
Larry Rainey Thomas thinks that there was an inevitability to it all. He points to 1898, when Wilmington was the site of the only successful coup d'etat in American history. Then, white supremacists overthrew a duly elected government, a government led by black Republicans and white populists. An untold number were slain, and the existence of a vibrant black community was under attack. Thomas says to fully appreciate the Wilmington 10, you must acknowledge the massacre of 73 years earlier.
1898 is the crux of the matter, as far as I'm concerned. And I have started an organization, and what I'm doing is seeking compensation and reparations for the victims, the descendants of the victims of 1898. That's what I think. You know, when people ask me, how do you solve this problem? You solve that problem by compensating the people who were robbed and compensating the community. The community was robbed of their self-esteem, economically and politically. You know, it took the hide out of the community. You know, it's like cutting a person's leg off. You're moving at a certain speed, you're doing certain things, you're making progress, then all of a sudden, your legs are cut off. And that took the wind out of the African-American community. And it has yet to recover.
Larry Rainey Thomas lives in Chapel Hill these days. He's the author of The True Story Behind the Wilmington 10. The mere mention of Williston High School still brings a smile to his face. Willie Earl Vereen, now in his mid-60s, says it all feels like it was just last week. He still lives in Wilmington by himself in a house that he paid for with money he received for the wrongful conviction. He has yet to put down the drumsticks. And he, too, is an author. His book is titled Wilmington 10 Willie, Guilt by Association. This weekend marks 50 years since the firebombing of Mike's Grocery. The WUNC Politics Podcast drops on Tuesdays and Fridays. Thanks to Grant Hullab-Mormon, Anita Rao, and Lindsay Foster Thomas for helping to bring this episode together. Join us again at the end of the week as we review some of what happened in the world of North Carolina politics. Aisha Dew and Clark Reamer will be by for the conversation. Until then, make sure you subscribe to the Politics Pod and also Embodied and Tested, Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google Play. My name is Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for listening.